Blog Talk Radio. Where not just women are in danger, but all marginalized people. Where being uniquely different right now might truly be considered a crime. It seems as though we had all slipped into a false sense of comfort, that justice would prevail and that good would win in the end. Well, good did not win this election, but good will win in the end. So what today means is that we are far from the end. Today marks the beginning of our story. The revolution starts here. The fight for the right to be free, to be who we are, to be equal. Let's march together through this darkness, and with each step, know that we are not afraid. That we are not alone. That we will not back down. That there is power in our unity, and that no opposing force stands a chance in the face of true solidarity. And to our detractors that insist that this march will never add up to anything.
Austin Red here with Friday Java, a weekly magazine of political theory, polling, and commentary. It is part of the history called people that make up this fascinating journey. We are part of the Obama Network. For that, we make no apologies. What we pledge to do is give you the facts on a bridge to history, what body politics is, the most up-to-date theories of political science and psychology. Stay tuned for this incredible ride. Austin Red, peace out.
Friday Java on the 8th of February 2019, beaming from WBRN Radio and on the Boston Red Network. Boston Red here in the Jerry Pippen broadcast booth. We had some technical difficulties. As many have heard, perhaps, we've been working on a new media server, and there obviously are still some problems. But nonetheless, we are here, and this is Friday Java, and we'll move right into it. With much sadness, we announce the passing of Frank Robinson. He was, of course, a Hall of Famer. This is from the Los Angeles Times. The first African-American, a big league manager. I thought that was Larry Doby. But anyway, he was a Hall of Famer, out the only major league manager to be named Most Valuable Player. A major league, excuse me, in both the National and American League. The first African-American to manage in the big leagues, died on Thursday in Los Angeles after a long illness, according to Major League Baseball. He was 83 years old. He rose from the sandlots of Oakland to become one of baseball's most feared sluggers. His 586 home runs, 10th on the baseball all-time list. Frank Robinson, resume in our game is without a parallel, a trailblazer in every sense. Those who impact span generations. That's from the Commissioner Manfred. It said in a statement he was one of the greatest players in the history of our game. But that was just the beginning of a multi-faceted baseball career. Robertson, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1982, spent more than 60 years in baseball. 21 as a big league player from 1956 to 1976. As a manager for franchises, more than a dozen in a variety of executive roles, most recently as special advisor to Manfred and honorary president of the American League. He left an indelible mark as a player. Whitty stands 6'1", 184 pounds, a power hitter with a career 294, not shabby at all, and an on-base percentage of 389, a slugging percentage of 537, and he was a 12-time All-Star. I don't rank guys, but I put him right there with the best ever. That's the late manager Earl Weaver in Baltimore when Robinson played for the Orioles, said in 2011, Earl the Pearl. He'd be a lot higher in the rankings if not for some artificial home runs that came out of those bats. When Robinson retired as a player after spending three of his final season with the Los Angeles Dodgers in 1972 and the Angels in 1983 and 84, he ranked fourth on the all-time baseball home run list behind Hank Aaron, Babe Ruth, and Willie Mays. He has since been passed by six others, including Albert Pujols, excuse me, of the Angels, and three of those players, Barry Bonds, Alex Rodriguez, and Sammy Sosa, have been linked to performance-enhancing drugs. Frank Robinson and I were both baseball buddies. We were friends. That's from Hank Aaron. Hank Aaron is now 85 years old. A longtime rival, he said in a statement on Thursday. Frank was a hard-nosed baseball player who did all things on the field that people said could never be done. I'm so glad that I had a chance to know him for all those years. Baseball will miss a tremendous human being. Robinson was one of the game's most fierce competitors, first in Cincinnati, where in 10 seasons he won the National League Rookie of the Year. It was in 1956, the MVP in 1961, then in Baltimore, where he led the Orioles to World Series titles in 1966 and 1970. He won the American League MVP and the Triple Crown honor in 1966, leading the league in with an average of .316, 49 home runs, and runs batted in at 122. He won the World Series VIP honor that October, hitting two home runs in the Orioles' four-game sweep of the L.A. Dodgers. He was a force in the batter's box, hitting for average and power, and in the dugout, the clubhouse, leading by example, infusing his team with grit. He expected nothing less than a maximum effort and intensity for him, from himself and his teammates. He backed down for no one, especially opposing pitchers, who all but dared them to knock him down by crowding the plate. He hated all pitchers with a passion. That's from Elrod Hendricks, that was a former Orioles teammate, who died in 2005. They were trying to take money out of his pocket and food out of his family's mouth. The late Gene Marsh was said to have fined his pitcher when he managed the Philadelphia Phillies for throwing at Robinson because such a tactic only served to motivate him. Still, Robinson was hit by pitches 198 times in his career. That's a lot of times. Leading the league in that category seven times. pitchers did me a favor when they knocked me down, Robertson told Baseball Digest, a venerable publication. It made me more determined that I would let the pitcher get me out. There's a pitcher here I'm looking at, Frank Robinson, Joe Morgan. And let's see who else is in this. Dusty Baker. I thought it was Dusty. Yeah. Born in 1935 on the 31st of August in Beaumont, Texas. Robinson was the youngest of 10 children who was essentially a single-parent household. Robinson's father deserted the family when he was an infant. His mother, Ruth, struggled to provide her children with basic necessities. When Robinson was four, his mother moved the family to West Oakland. It was a playground near his house on Lower Marriott Street in that Robinson's hard-nosed approach to the game was formed. Every player, even playing pickup games as a youngster, he would slide hard into second base to break up a double play. That way, baseball's supposed to be played, Robinson said during his Hall of Fame induction speech in 1982. Let me finish this up. It's a rather long article here. Let's see here. Oh, yeah, this is... Frank Robinson was someone I looked up to as a man and as a baseball player and tried to emulate him. That is from Tony Clark, executive director of the Players Union, said on Thursday. His skills and ferocity on the field they were matched by dignity and a sense of fair play off the diamond. The fraternity of players and the baseball family have lost a giant. Robinson had asked umps to check the glove of Angels reliever Brendan Donnelly when pine tar, an illegal substance still around today, used to get a better grip on the ball, was found. Donnelly was ejected. Mike Sosa approached Robinson in 69 along the first baseline and threatened to have the Giants pitcher undressed in a in search of a foreign substance. Socha turned his back to Robinson and began walking towards the Angels dugout, but Robinson followed him, crowning with a few choice words of his own. The two managers then stood at home plate, jawing at each other and angrily pointing in a confrontation that looked like it might turn physical. Players from both benches emptied their bullpens and stormed onto the field. I wasn't going to let him intimidate me, Robinson said the next day. I am the intimidator, old Mike Socha. Mike Socha also retired. Robinson, who went on to become a pioneer for blacks in sports management and executive ranks, is one of 13 African-American managers in the big leagues. He was willing to give time and money by going to Puerto Rico to get experience so he could become the first African-American manager. Weaver said lots of guys wouldn't do that. He had the intelligence to be able to do it, and I was proud of him. Interesting choice of words that he used there. The family said in lieu of flowers, make a donation to the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee, or the National Museum of African-American History and Culture in Washington. It's interesting they didn't designate National League Hall of Fame Museum in Kansas City. Anyway, this is Frank Robinson, dead at 83 years old. I didn't know Frank had been sick. There's a picture of him here in 1998 with none other than Sandy Koufax. He's still alive today. And moving around, another picture of Robinson and from the L.A. Times. Also, the passing of John Dingell, the Dean of the Senate. I don't know if I have it up here or not, but John Dingell was an extraordinary person. He was in the House of Representatives for 59 years. He was out of Dearborn, Michigan. His wife now represents that district. John Dingell was literally a page in the House when Franklin Delano Roosevelt made his famous "We have nothing to fear but fear" speech. Is a page. His father represented the district before John Dingell did. And when his father died, John Dingell took over. His father, of course, was a New Dealer. In the 50s, he was there for the 64 Civil Rights Act, the Housing Act. He took some flack in his district in Dearborn at the time for his advance of civil rights. And he was also active in the passage of the Environmental Act there, and of environmental acts, I should say, and when the Environmental Protection Agency was established. He ran afoul of environmentalists because of his support, and obviously would have support for the automobile industry there in Detroit. And he also supported the bailout. He was around for Barack Obama. He had presented legislation every term, and he had many, many terms, over 30 of them, basically, of national health care. He was there for the Affordable Care Act, one of the major movements of that. He retired in 2015. Of course, his death at 92. We'll have more on John Dingell on the week that was tomorrow night. And let me just see if we do have John Dingell here. Dies at 92. The picture of John Dingell standing here, had his cane at the time, and Mr. Bing, who was the mayor of Detroit, you see him towering up there, a lot of tall people, and Barack Obama. He died at 92. And let me just see, this is the Detroit Free Press. I don't know what we can get or can't get here. We'll see. Or we'll attempt to see at least. This is a video here, and as usual, they have all kinds of videos running around. And I'm not certain as to what this so-called video is. Well, it just turned out to be a picture of John Dingell. Anyway, nonetheless, John Dingell, the ex-Michigan lawmaker, was like in a private, according to this, and all kinds of things, iconic legislature, venerable living symbol of Southeast Detroit. A former Representative Dingell was more than that to people who knew him. Yes, he was a master legislator, a powerful speaker, no doubt about that. A skilled political tactician. But the longest serving member of Congress, a man who helped write and pass, it was a Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, and many other most consequential pieces of legislation in the past three quarters of a century. It was more than that. To a hunter, a sports fan, a proud Michigander, compassionate, words there, made no secret of his love of junk food and desserts. Anyway, well, he got his desserts. Evidently, he died finally of prostate cancer. A political investigation well done. John DeSanto, now a political consultant, remembered working for Dingell as his driver, as well as a job he could barely hope for coming out of Wayne State University at 22. That was in the mid-90s. He quickly got a chance to show his work. One night, DeSanto went by himself to Middy's restaurant in Dearborn's Dingle's home base as he ordered his meal. He noticed Jim DeSanto in... wait a minute here. DeSanto, excuse me, the mayor of Wadada, I don't know where that is, anyway. Switch to run, as a Republican against Dingle. I saw there and took notes on every piece of paper I could lay my hands on. And Dingle then told me, Joseph, I have run an investigative committee for 20 years. This is the best investigation that's ever been done. And let's see, a trick play in the 1964. It may be lost to ages, but now several people who work for Dingle recall a story he told about the 1964 race, one in which he was put in a district with another incumbent congressman, John Laskinski. Then he ran, they ran against each other in the Democratic primary, and the main issue there, and this is what we were talking about earlier here, couldn't have been more strike. Dingle had voted for the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Laskinski was the only Northern Democrat who voted against it. But as the story goes, Laskinski's campaign had created a flyer for different communities in the district based on which side of the legislation they might come down on. In African-American communities, the literature appeared in one set of issues, in white another set of issues. Someone on Dingle's team apparently got the list of which communities were supposed to get which flyers. However, they switched them. I believe that to be a true story. DeSanto said he heard it from Dingle himself. The 64 race can't be discounted. He saw it at the time. And what's going to be judged as a result, be damned. Now DeSantos added with a playful creepy in his voice, that doesn't excuse any act of chicanery on the road to victory. A master hunter, Dingle made no bones about he loved to hunt, and in his office in Washington, he kept all sorts of hunting memorabilia. One former staffer remembers fondly that he was so elated that he could describe a Russian ballet, and then in the next, in the next breath, let you know how to gut an elk without getting any blood on the second knuckle. So anyway, we'll continue this to John Dingle. On to Virginia, the other big story. I was talking to each about this. This is Tommy Norment, was editor of Virginia Military Academy yearbook, filled with racist pictures, slurs, and so forth and so on. In 1968, a revelation about one of Virginia's most powerful Republicans comes as a state Democratic governor, etc. Their blackface moments. And then, various racial slurs in the book. The governor in Virginia has, Ralph Northam has not resigned. And then the lieutenant governor has his own situation. We'll get to that in a minute. Fairfax. And then we have a hearing, the attorney general. And his brown face moment. So we have all these characters situations going on. And let's see, Kurt Cox, a fellow Republican, he's the House Speaker, said in a statement that Senator Normant has enthusiastically condemned the racist and abhorrent photos in the yearbook, as I do. Oh, well. But he was the editor. What we were talking about with H was a culture of racism in Virginia, coming from the days of Robert E. Lee, when he had his headquarters, the Confederate headquarters, there in Richmond in Virginia. So you have to understand that this culture is so embedded that it was allowed to kill Heber Heyer, and we always dedicate this program to her. We'll have the people from the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, in a minute here. Another white supremacist fell there. He did an Alford plea. What that is when the evidence is so overwhelming by the prosecutor, although in his mind he was not guilty, he pled guilty. So, but again, this whole cultural situation is, back in the 60s, yes, they were doing blackface. They were doing Confederate uniforms. All of this was still there, remnants of 1868 and not 1960, 100 years. About 100 years of that culture, and it extended into the 80s. And what has basically happened with the minstrel show, I think I was hearing this on National Public Radio. Rarely listen to National Public, but I was listening, and anyway, nonetheless, this whole cultural thing of the minstrel show being taken out of quote-unquote public space and put in private space where majority of Europeans were. And this would have been the Virginia Military Academy at the time. I went to spend about 2 hours talking to an African-American Marine that actually was a product of the Virginia Military Academy. And then he had been a Marine for over 10 years, was stationed in various places, etc. And he was retiring from the Marine Corps. He was a very bitter man. But the whole cultural, back to the cultural thing, the minstrel show, the absolute apex of white supremacy, something that went on and on and on, but even went to entertainers. Al Jolson, one of the more popular entertainers in the whole country, went around with the blackface deal, and you also had other entertainers on radio. You had Amos and Andy. A comedy, very interesting comedy, but they were played at the time by European people. So this is one of those situations that you had out of the minstrel shows. You had people in blackface, even Africans in blackface, you believe that one. And of all, Mickey Mouse, because Mickey Mouse, you know, was a black figure, but he had on these white gloves. That was part of the act also, that they had this. But anyway, this cultural thing that became not acceptable in the open was acceptable in certain areas. Now, in the yearbooks, in fact, this medical school had to discontinue their yearbook. It was a student project. This is where old Northam himself was snared up in that situation. So those are some of the things that come out of this. You have to understand this overwhelming Confederate thing. And this has been put on steroids by the Make America Great Again. This harps back to the 60s. That's what the code word, dog whistle, whatever you want to call it, is there. So now the Democrats in Virginia are in deep trouble, no doubt about it. They got a governor, and the lieutenant governor, separate situation there. But the African caucus there in Virginia still is calling for the resignation of the governor. We're not sure where the attorney general stands in this. And an investigation of Fairfax. If you recall, back with the Al Franken incident, there was going to be a Senate investigation, and there should have been a Senate investigation, and there would be an investigation of this. But the problem is, with Dr. Tyson's allegation, that was in 2004. And now Bobby, what's his name, from Virginia there, said he'd heard about it. He actually knows her personally, but he claimed he did not know the details. And this is Vanessa Tyson's a full statement on Justin Fairfax. She accused Fairfax, Lieutenant Governor, of sexual assaulting her in the 2004 Democratic Convention that was in Boston. She released her statement there, and we'll go into this on the week that was. Let's go to the crystal ball here now. Our time is running late. It's, 4:06 now? Anyway, yes, Virginia, this is chaos. This is by Larry Sabato and Kyle Klondike. This is a special edition of the Crystal Ball, giving you fast-moving developments in our home state. The story has rocked, Democratic Party in Richmond. Doesn't really begin with the report from the conservative news. This is this big league politics that Rev Northam, in a medical school, contained a picture of two people, one dressed in a Klan robe and one in a blackface. The big league told the Washington Post over the weekend that the abortion comment has spurred the public emergence of the yearbook. The source of the tip appeared to have been a medical school classmate. Our classmates of Norfolk, who acted as a direct result of the abortion controversy that erupted early in the week, according to two people at Big League Politics, a right-wing site. As bigger outlets confirmed the authenticity of the photo, Norfolk released a statement on Friday and then a video message taking ownership of and apologizing for the picture. Of course, later he recanted, yet Norton offered without prompting that in the same year he appeared in a form of blackface, and this was a Michael Jackson situation there. Following the press conference, Norton rapidly diminishing support for the collapse, Senator Tim Kaine and Mark Warner, two top officials there, call for him to give it up, and his predecessors Terry McAuliffe and former Governor Douglas Wilde, an African American. He was the first African American elected governor in Virginia. Best we can let their reality is only one true major Democrat who has held elective office recently had not weighed in against Northam. Former President Barack Obama, who campaigned for Northam in 2017, Northam must hope that the press conference would allow him to gain some measure of control of the story. He lost. He's now hired as Northam, that is, a PR agency. The Morning Consult, with continual monitoring, the approval rating of major state found at 41%. Found a 41 percentage point drop in Northam's approval rating over the weekend. With many expected Northam to resign, the focus had turned to the man who replaced him. That was Fairfax. For the Democrats, particularly those running for president and not involved in Virginia politics, asking for Northam's resignation was an easy decision. There was an opportunity to stand on principle and racism as added benefit without costing Democrats any power. After running a very competitive campaign for a Democratic Attorney General nominee in 13, lost to Mark Herring, who is now in his second term as Attorney General. Fairfax won the Lieutenant Governor's post in 2017. prior to this Virginia crisis, his last notable news event had been setting out a tribute. Oh, good God. Setting out a tribute to Robert E. Lee in the Virginia Senate, the body over which a lieutenant governor otherwise presides. Fairfax, an African American, had his ancestors' manuscript documents in his pocket when sworn in as a lieutenant governor. Given Virginia's racial history, Fairfax elevation to governor in the aftermath of Norfolk's possible resignation because of the governor's apparent involvement in a racist cultural tradition, same thing we talked about. Let me just move this on here. But as the weekend grew to a close, rumors began to fly about old Fairfax and his own problems. But he's not old, he's only 39 years old. After many had gone to bed on Sunday night, the Big League Politics, its right-wing site, reported that Fairfax had been accused of sexual assault stemming from an incident 15 years ago, a long time ago. That would have put Fairfax in his 20s. He's 39 now. Following a Fairfax statement, the story spilled into mainstream media, and the Washington Post picked it up. Jim Bayosos, incidentally the owner of the Washington Post, now his own story. The Big League Politics, named the accuser, but the larger organization has declined to do it. We have her statement here in the Vanessa Tyson, politics professor at Scripps College in California. It remains unclear as to whether Northam will resign. Ultimately, the only one that can make that decision is Northam himself. Virginia Constitution standards for impeachment are not really compatible here. They're not going to impeach him for that. Will President Obama weigh in? Well, he doesn't want to get into that situation. The only major Democratic voice who matters here, Warfam has never struck us as a person who is interested in the office higher than the one he holds. Unlike McCulloch, who is talking about trying to run for office. Oh, Bob McDonald, old McDonald there, a very easy, could have managed to run for the Senate. But Northam is just happy to be the governor. Since the press conference, the governor has not provided any additional. In fact, he's been laying low. There remains some legal uncertainties about what precisely would happen in the event of Northam's resignation. Fairfax could become the governor. He would get to appoint a replacement. However, it's unclear whether that person would be on the ballot with opponents in a separate special election this fall to fill the remaining two terms based on a 1971 procedure, the last time a vacancy in a lieutenant governor's office was filled. Oh, I see. There's already a scheduled election in November of 140 seats in the House of Delegates and the State Senate, along with local officials. So they have a big election coming up in November of this year. The General Assembly or the State Supreme Court may have to decide Fairfax. Meanwhile, I could run for his full term in 2021. The Virginia governors are barred from seeking a re-election. It's the only state that does not allow a governor to be elected to two consecutive terms. I didn't remember that. I think I saw it before. But because Fairfax was not actually elected to be governor, he could run for re-election if he became governor. He would be the first Virginia governor to be able to run for re-election as an incumbent in post-Civil War era. Now, again, this is Virginia back to the Civil War. You can see it here. This is what the problem is. Even before the allegations against Fairfax emerged, the fact that her yearbook was at the center of Norfolk's troubles already reminds us a bit of the battle over Kavanaugh. But now there are much clearer parallels between Kavanaugh and Fairfax's situation because of the allegation of sexual assault. Well, the allegation of sexual assault now with Kavanaugh was totally different. Kavanaugh effectively denied he was there. And some people said he was not there the night of the assault. Now, with Fairfax, yes, he was there. They did have an affair. They did kiss, etc. But it went beyond that. So a little different situation. In the event that both Northam and Fairfax resigned, the Attorney General Herring would become the governor in the immediate aftermath of Northam's bombshell and Fairfax seeming likely ascendancy to the ascension to the governor. Though we fought back to Herring's decision to defer to Northam in advance anyway. The mess. Let me finish this up. Looming over all this is the upcoming state legislative elections in Virginia this November. And let's see, some Virginia Democrats, operatives even before the current mess, were concerned that the white hot intensified of that feud of the Democrats in 2017 and 2018 might cool. Particularly without any statewide election on the ballot, low turnouts might help the Republicans, whose vote base in Virginia and elsewhere can be more reliable in off-year elections. Me not this time around. Anyway, this is what they had. If Northam stays, we could see the Democratic state legislative candidates running on impeaching their own party's governor. Not impossible.